The Last Concert Cafe, Saturday, July 25th, for the 29th Annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social, a benefit for your community radio station, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch means it's Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? The coolest place on your dial because it's the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubichek, Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Houston Downtown, along with our guest relations rep and absolutely essential team player, Shannon McKerchie. You know, good storytellers possess similar qualities. They connect with listeners on an emotional level, convey clear points of view, transport us into fanciful worlds through magical tools of expression, and deliver well-defined details and events. Great tellers get us to feel something, and it doesn't matter the emotion. However, few storytellers can do what tonight's guest teller can do, and that is to communicate within his stories a moment when people see themselves or someone in their lives. When this extraordinary trait is coupled with humor, the outcome produces what businessman Alan Klein claims we need to live a healthful life, a way to alter any situation and help us cope at the very instant we are laughing. Brendan Bourque-Scheele is the teller to whom I refer as this special breed of talent, and this being his three-peat appearance sort of proves the point. Brendan is a teaching artist for the Alley Theater's Department of Education and Community Engagement. His feature-length play, The Book of Maggie, is set to premiere at Stages Repertory Theater in January of next year. In the meantime, you can hear his writing come to life at Boodtown's Grown-Up Storytime, where he's a regular contributor, and see his writing out on his blog, BrendanBourque-Scheele.wordpress.com. That's BrendanBourque-Scheele.wordpress.com. Brendan's work has been published on Crack.com, EverydayFiction.com, and Nerd Titan, all are Pulitzer Prize-winning periodicals. Only kidding. All right, very good. Okay. Where he's an editor-at-large, he's also a great supporter of this program and the mission of Pacifica Radio. We're thrilled and tickled, Pink, to have you here.
Thank you.
You must not have a life, because here you are again.
Clearly.
Clearly. But you know what? Congratulations on your play.
Thank you so much.
And I know that you want to give us a synopsis, and I think you talked about it at one point, but give us a description of The Book of Maggie. What's that about?
Okay. Well, there's no way to say this without sounding mildly offensive to someone.
Uh-huh.
But Judas Iscariot and Pontius Pilate are the main characters, you know, typical everyman.
Yeah.
And they're in the afterlife, and they're assigned by St. Peter to stage a divine intervention on Earth and help some people out.
Yeah. How do you come up with that? I mean, how do you come up with that configuration? Do you just dream things and write them out, or are you taking certain medications, or what exactly do you do to make that happen?
Years of daydreaming at Mass, probably.
Yeah. Well, you know, Stages is a magnificent venue and one of the most prestigious rep theaters around, and I want to talk to you more about that and a little bit more about your teaching as well, because I know that's something that you are seriously passionate about, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. Give us a quick feel for what you do, though, as a teacher. We're going to talk more about it, but what do you do?
As a teaching artist, I go to high schools around Houston as a representative of the Alley Theater, okay. And I teach playwriting to students of creative writing, theater usually. Mm-hmm. With them, I work on writing 10-minute plays over the course of like 12
wow.
class sessions.
Magnificent. And are these kids who are interested in playwriting?
Do they want to be there?
Well, do you instill playwriting interests in them?
I sure try to instill.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm successful.
Well, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that you are, Brendan. You're a great artist. Let's get to your story. It's a tasty story, pun very much intended, because it's about Twinkies, right? About Twinkies. Okay. That iconic snack and the most delectable gustatory experience of the 20th century. Is there any background you want us to know about the story before you get started?
I think I'd like to start by luxuriating in the mystery, so no.
Okay, good. I like that. Go.
I didn't grow up in a house with a lot of rules. My mothers were children of the 60s. They were anti-censorship, anti-traditional gender roles. They were kind of anti-parenting, to be honest. So they didn't place a lot of limitations on me in terms of what I could wear, what I could say, what I could listen to. But there was one very specific and very rigidly enforced rule about what I could eat. I wasn't allowed to have Twinkies. I'd see them everywhere. Obviously, they're like one of the most popular snack foods in America. I'd see them at school, on television. But whenever I tried to get brave and like slip them into the grocery cart at HEB, my parents would really put their foot down. They'd be like, absolutely not, put it back, don't even think about it. It was very weird to see them suddenly become authoritarian, but for reasons that they never really explained to me, they were just anti-Twinkie. And I knew it had nothing to do with the health consciousness, because we were not a health conscious family. At that age, at like age 10, I was like 30% corn syrup. So I wondered what it was about Twinkies that was offending my mom so much, but they never really covered it. And it bothered me for a while, but over time, I accepted it. And after that, I sort of started to embrace it. It became like a personal identifier for me. I saw myself as part of a no Twinkie household. And sure, it was a confusing and seemingly nonsensical restriction to place on someone, but if you put enough nonsensical restrictions together, you have a religion. And the no Twinkie thing became like my family's personal religion. Basically, I started to see Twinkies the way that Mormons see coffee, or the way that Muslims see pork, or the way that Catholics see fun. And I might have gone on like that. I might have spent the rest of my life irrationally hating Twinkies. But I went to college, and as we all know, college is the place where moral values are questioned and junk food is beloved above everything else. So it's one night early in freshman year, and I find myself in one of those gatherings that happen at underclassmen dorms, you know, where like eight people crowd into one dorm room and share a case of beer. I'm in this room, I'm getting drunk for the first time in my life, and as we all drink, we all start to get very hungry, so we appoint a two-person task force to go out and get food for everybody. And in quintessential underclassmen stoner fashion, they come back with three bags full of one kind of food, Twinkies. And they dump them out in front of all of us like the take from a heist. I'm watching this mountain of sin pile up in front of me, and I'm watching the other people in the room light up in excitement at the prospect of gorging on Twinkies. And morally, I'm very disapproving, but metabolically, I'm starving, and I'm really interested in trying these things. And I think, you know what? I'm going to try one. I don't see what the harm would be. And as I'm reaching for one, I hear this foreboding, very innocent-sounding voice in my head say, "Don't do it, Brendan. Don't give in to the Twinkies. Have more beer instead. Keep drinking until you're violently ill, if that's what it takes. Just please don't do something you're going to regret here." But then, in the midst of this voice, there was this other voice, and it said, "Come on, man. You've never really bought into the whole no Twinkies thing. You were never a true believer. And why would you be? What reason could there possibly be not to eat golden cream-filled cake?" And while there's this war happening in my head, this gorgeous girl to my right, she taps me on the shoulder, and she says, "Have you ever tried Twinkies in the microwave? It's better than sex." And I looked at her and I said, "I have to go." And I ran out of the room. And I caught my breath in the hallway and I said to myself, what is so wrong with eating Twinkies? I'm gonna go back in there, I'm gonna collect myself, I'm gonna eat a Twinkie. But then I thought, no, I can't do that. I have to check with my mom first. There might be some really good reason why we don't eat Twinkies. Maybe I'll like explode on the spot if I eat one or something. So I have to check with her. So I call my mom up. She's very groggy on the other end of the phone. She says, "Brendan, it's 2 AM, are you okay?" And I say, "You need to tell me why we don't eat Twinkies right now." She says, "What? Are you drunk?" I say, "That's irrelevant, Mom. You need to tell me about the Twinkies or I'm about to go eat a mountain of them." And she says, okay. And I hear herself kind of like collecting her thoughts on the other end of the phone. And I hear her get up and she says, So we've told you about Harvey Milk, right? And I was baffled. I said, yeah, so? She says, well, this concerns him. Okay, so for anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know who Harvey Milk is, he was an absolutely seminal figure in the gay rights movement. He was one of the first openly gay men to ever hold public office. When he was serving as a district supervisor for the Castro District in San Francisco, he passed groundbreaking gay rights legislation. And his work was especially impactful to my moms, who were young lesbian women living in San Francisco at the time he was in office. But as some of you probably know, his career was cut tragically short. He was shot. In City Hall, in fact, along with Mayor George Moscone, by their disgruntled former colleague, Dan White. I knew all this before this conversation with my mom, but what my mom explained to me were some details of the ensuing trial. See, Dan White, before the shootings, had been a very upstanding citizen. He'd been a cop and a firefighter. He'd been a moral arbiter of his community. And the people who knew him were very hard-pressed to believe he could have done what he did had he been in his right mind. The defense argued that his mental state leading up to the shooting was one of diminished capacity. They said that he was too depressed to have been in his right mind, and they cited changes in his diet as both a symptom and a contributing factor in his altered mental state. Before the shooting, White, who had normally been a very health-conscious guy, had been gorging himself on sodas and snack foods, namely Twinkies. And they said because he was so depressed before the shootings, even though he snuck into City Hall through an open window with a loaded .38, walked up flights of stairs to the mayor's office, shot the mayor, walked down the hall, reloaded, and shot Harvey Milk, his crimes could not have been committed with malice aforethought. The press called this argument the Twinkie defense, and apparently it worked, because Dan White avoided a murder charge, it got bumped down to manslaughter, he got sentenced to 7 years in jail, he paroled after five. When the gay community heard about the verdict, they were outraged. And the man who knew best how to channel their outrage into productive, meaningful change was dead and gone. There were riots. Things got really bad for a while. My mom explained all this to me over the phone, and she said after that verdict, she never wanted to have a Twinkie again. Had I been sober, I might have said, okay, Mom, this is clearly a very sensitive subject for you. Let's just leave it at that. Sorry for calling you so late. Had I been sober, that's what I might have said. But what I did say in the moment was, wait, I don't get it. She said, what don't you get, Brendan? I said, well, what did the Twinkies do wrong? Why are you punishing the Twinkies for something that Dan White did? And she said, well, I'm not giving the Hostess Company money after they helped his defense. And I said, Mom, I think there's been a huge misallocation of blame here. And she said, Brendan, I just told you that the man who shot Harvey Milk only spent 5 years in jail. You think maybe you're focusing your outrage on the wrong part of this story? And I probably should have realized at that point that I was kind of in the wrong here, but instead I doubled down. I said, the Twinkies did nothing wrong here, Mom. They were innocent bystanders. Are you telling me I haven't been eating Twinkies for 19 years because you accidentally boycotted the wrong people? And I could hear her getting very frustrated on her end of the phone. She said, Brendan, I don't know what you want from me at this point. I'm sorry I apparently ruined your childhood by not letting you eat Twinkies. This was a very emotional time for me. In the moment, it made sense to not eat Twinkies. I'm sorry. What do you want from me? And I started to realize at this point that I was completely in the wrong, but way too committed to back down. Because had I taken 2 seconds to view this conversation outside my sugar-crazed prism, I might have realized that to my mom, Twinkies were inexorably linked to a time in her life when she was young and alone in a new city. Part of a disenfranchised people who were at best ignored and at worst harassed by their own government and police. And then this white knight had come along. Harvey Milk, mayor of Castro Street, local business owner, bearing her banner, fighting her fight, actually changing things. You know, Harvey Milk famously used to say, you got to give him hope. And he did for her. And then one day he was just gone. He was gunned down in the place where he worked. And the people who mourned him didn't get justice. Instead, they got some asinine story about how the gunman didn't pull that trigger, the Twinkies did. And boycotting Twinkies because of that wasn't exactly a rational act, but the things that people do in times of great loss usually aren't. You know, when good people die, grief and blame tend to spread in unexpected ways. And I should have been sympathetic to that, but instead I just yelled at her over Twinkies, of all things. The conversation ended about a minute later on a very tense note. I went back into my friend's dorm room and I tried my first Twinkie, and it was repulsive. After years spent picturing Twinkies as some kind of Midas-made confectionery opus, the sticky stale taste of processed sponge cake and cream that's not actually cream tasted as bitter and disgusting as I felt. And I spent the next few days kind of wallowing around campus. And then a week later, my mom called me. And she said, "Brendan, I thought about what you said, and I decided to try a Twinkie." I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah." And it was disgusting. And I said, "Yes, right? They taste like the mop at a candy factory." And she laughed, and I was so relieved, because once again, we were back in accord. Once again, we were a no-Twinkie household. And everything felt right with the world.
Beautiful. You know, this is something that you'll rarely hear me say, but I'm speechless. I mean, I'm totally speechless. This was a magnificent story, and the jumble of emotions that you offer is pretty incredible. I mean, this was a pretty poignant tale. It was a pretty poignant tale. How dare you want to eat a Twinkie is what I'm thinking. How dare you do that to your mother? I mean, man cannot live by Twinkie alone. Who cares about a Twinkie? Really, no kidding.
That was very poignantly inserted.
No, that was a beautiful, beautiful story. And no hyperbole, that was a beautiful story. What is it that you want us, and you inserted a beautiful parable. You genuinely did. But in a sentence or two, what is it that you want us to extract from that story? What do you want us to know? Because Harvey Milk was indeed a very significant figure. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the term, the Twinkie trial, so to speak, arose from a journalist, Herb Kahn, who thought it would be a very catchy way of giving people an opportunity to understand the absurdity of his defense, as you pointed out very eloquently. Mm-hmm. But what is it that you want us to know from that story?
I think the story, first and foremost, is owed as an homage to Harvey Milk, without whom many great things in my parents' life would not be possible. But there's another aspect to this, which is reacting to other people's grief and giving them room to not always be rational, and to not always be basically just giving people room to grieve.
Right. Well, that's an excellent point. You know, rationality is really overrated. It is.
Yeah.
And sometimes at big time, especially among the human condition. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek with Shannon McCurchy, and you are listening to So What's Your Story with our guest teller, Brendan Bourque-Scheel, only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston, or kpft.org if you're listening online. But whatever path you took to get here, we are glad you did. Shannon, you've eaten Twinkies, haven't you?
Not very often. But
you know what? I knew she was going to say that. I knew it.
I don't like
anything,
it.
Anything.
I don't like it. Yeah,
this is a person.
Like,
oh, come on.
This
is a person, and I'm never going to let you live this one down, when during our Halloween show, I asked her, "What's your favorite thing at Trick or Treat?" You know what she said? Gum.
Wow.
I don't like candy. I like
really?
Mine instead.
Please. You know what? I don't know. There's something wrong with her. That's
Clearly.
Why we love her so much. She belongs here because she's... nuts. She's out of her mind. I am, you are, we all are.
Agreed.
I think that's probably one of the prerequisites. But here, given the researcher that I am, I do have a PhD, you know, so I am a scholar, and I decided to do some research about the Twinkie. I just want everybody to know this. This has got some depth, this show.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. The Twinkie was invented in Schiller Park, Illinois, on April 6, 1930, by James Alexander Dewar, the baker for the Continental Baking Company. And the original one had banana cream. I remember this, which really dates me, but later replaced with vanilla cream during the banana rationing in World War II. A strawberry cream was introduced in 1988, but that was soon dropped, and you can imagine why. What is that, strawberry, right? And the banana flavor was reintroduced in 2007, and occasionally you can find it, but it often whispers the obvious forgotten truth, and that is vanilla rules. Now, unlike you and the rest of the world, I think Twinkies rock. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I'm not suggesting that I want 9 for dinner, but I mean, if you stuck a Twinkie in front of me, there's a really, really good chance that I wouldn't turn it down. There's a good chance. I'm not saying there's an absolute chance, but there's a pretty good chance.
Oh, no disrespect to Twinkies.
Yeah, no, I never had one in a microwave, so I can't respond to your friend. Where did you go to school again?
Texas State. Predictably.
Right. That's where they have swings in the front yard.
Agreed, yes.
Right, very good. So, of course, that's what they do there. Yeah. Okay, I got you. You know, if this program were a Twinkie, however, Shannon would be the cream filling. You like that one? I even planned that one because that has to be a natural segue.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. I know. Yeah, gum. Shannon, tell our listeners what they will find when they visit our So What's Your Story Facebook, please.
Well, Hank, everything from our information about our fabulous tellers every week and upcoming storytelling events around town. And some great articles about everything from promoting senior wellness through storytelling as a path towards wellness, refugee and immigrant speak through StoryCorps.
Why do you look at me when you say senior wellness?
I wasn't looking at you.
I'm just wondering. You were, Shannon.
Oh.
I mean, come on.
Well, I guess I'm called out then, huh?
Yeah. You know, you look at me like I'm really old. When I went to school, they had history, you know? I just want you to know that. Go ahead. Continue.
Okay. Thank you. An article about Alan Lomax, the famed folklorist. He has a massive archive that's now available online. And a few other interesting things, like 5 top stories behind iconic photos of history.
Yeah, so. And you do a great job. You do a great job. You know that I love you, and you know you do a great job. And I check out a lot of Facebook pages. I don't do a lot of posting, and I don't do a lot of writing, but I read a lot of them. And I have to tell you something, unconditionally, Shannon does the best job. I mean, it is beautiful. It is consistent. She has a way of merging verbal and nonverbal stories. She keeps up on festivals about our guests, and I really appreciate that. She works so hard, especially learning about all of our guests, because our guests are unique. They are common folks with uncommon stories and wonderful lives, and we just love her to death, and I just want to thank her so much. Shannon, next week, our guest will be the second appearance of one of very talented, very funny Connor Clifton, another find of yours, another teller that you're not going to want to miss. But listen, hey, why would you want to miss any week of So What's Your Story? Right, Brandon? I mean, honestly.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to Connor. He's hilarious.
Yeah. I can see that you're just laughing. You're laughing. That was done so well. Yes. Uh-huh.
He really is.
He's hilarious. Very good. Yeah. You listen to this show every week, don't you?
I'm a pretty regular listener.
I think you're one of 3 or 4 people that tune in. Right? Isn't that right? Yeah. Now, if all of you have a hankering for learning more about the art of storytelling, then you've got to know this. When the proverbial cream rises, it is our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, that surfaces the best storyteller group around. Shannon, please remind us when and where they meet.
Well, Hank, the Houston Storytellers Guild meets the third Tuesday of every month, and that's from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Multi-Service Center at 1475 West Gray. And so upcoming, check out our website at HoustonStorytellers.org for all the fun happenings. And also there's including the upcoming event with Larry Thompson, a concert on August 29th.
Yeah, he's going to be great, and he's going to be here on the 27th.
Yes.
Yeah, and people are saying Larry Thompson, well, he is a world-renowned teller, and you'll have to just believe us and take a look at Facebook.
He won second place at the Liars Contest.
Right, and that's the truth. Yeah, that's the truth.
It was a heck of a story.
Yeah, you like that one? Yeah, it was a heck of a story. What was the story about? Because I did not go that year.
There were so many dynamic ones. I'm trying to place it.
Yeah, it made a real impact on you. I can see it was a great story. Yeah, think about that while you're thinking about stories about gum. Also, please visit our new program site at www.com. SoWhat'sYourStory.info for story photos, features, and fun, including pics from the book signing held last Friday at Brazos Bookstore. Shannon was just magnificent. Ben Rybeck at Brazos was wonderful. He's going to be a guest as well. Thank you to everyone, really, for the great turnout, and to Brazos, especially Ben, for hosting it with class and aplomb. Incidentally, if you have any questions about storytelling, have an idea for a program, or just want to inquire about a guest spot, let me know at drhank@kpft.org. You are listening to guest storyteller Brendan Borg-Scheel on Always Live, So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. Brendan, you are passionate about teaching playwriting at the Alley's Department of Education and Community Engagement. What is the Alley's role in community engagement?
The Alley teaches most theatrical disciplines at schools around Houston. They teach playwriting, Shakespeare, acting, slam poetry. And for the younger kids, they teach a program called Staging STEM, which integrates theatrical principles into core curriculum subjects like science and math.
Yeah, and community engagement is really the key. Playwriting is significant to the community. Learning about playwriting, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but why is that?
Why is learning about playwriting significant to the community? I think theater is, one of the oldest and most democratic art forms. It's an art form of the people, and that's why it's still around in an era of Netflix.
Who do your students consist of?
It's mostly theater students, creative writing students, and it's mostly high school age with some middle school mixed in. They're a ragtag bunch of outsiders mostly. Yeah. You get the theater kids, the weird kids.
Do they come wanting to learn about theater, or do they come saying, oh, my mom wants me to sit here and do something, so teach me something? I mean, what kind of attitude?
70-30 split towards the people who want to be there.
Yeah, but when all is said and done, they love it. What are some of the methods that you use to get their attention?
Oh, I make them do an exercise usually on the first day where I have them create a character who is the opposite of them.
Really?
To get them outside of writing their own voices. And they tend to either love or hate their opposites.
Who would the opposite be of you?
You.
Really?
I don't know. I have nothing to back that up.
Yeah, nothing to back that up.
Except what's standing right in front of me.
Right, exactly. So once you find a character that is the opposite of you, what do you do with that character?
Oh, what I have them
do...
You
have a dialogue with that? Do you talk to the person?
Yeah, what I have them do is I have them write a scene between themselves and their character where one of them is trapped behind a door and can only rely on help from the other.
Cool. Very, very cool. So there's some conflict there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at two opposite people who really have nothing in common, trying to maximize each other's resources in order to get out of a dilemma. Do you like that?
Yes. And most of them never get out of the dilemma.
They don't get out. What about Boot Town? Tell us about Boot Town.
Oh, Boot Town is such a cool scene. So if you're unfamiliar with the premise of the show, people send in stories that they've written, and then other people are assigned to read them. So your story gets read by someone other than yourself, which outwardly seems like a weird concept, but having other people's faces put to my stories has prompted me to write a lot of stories I might otherwise not have written.
Yeah, it is neat to see other people's ability to take their own tools of expression and put images to them, and it is pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's very, very cool. Brendan, it may be dark irony to quote the late Robin Williams to describe some of your personal narratives, but when he claimed that comedy is acting out optimism, it describes how you are able to deliver powerful themes and pepper them in with the right dose of quirky motifs to create a vibe of urgency and innocence, challenging opposites with which we struggle daily. You're one of those few very special tellers who do it so well, genuinely, so, so well. Brendan Borg-Scheel, thank you for your wit, your engaging style, and for possessing the buoyant personality that helps make you the consummate storyteller. You're going to be back on this show. Shannon and I are going to make sure of it. Scooter is up next with the Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every single day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, please join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story and ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and I'm going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. I'm Dr. Hank, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
members, come to one of our signing events at the KPFT station where you can hang out with KPFT staff and volunteers, enjoy light refreshments, and offer your signatures to some of the candidates running for the board. We will be having one on Thursday, July 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. and a final one on deadline day, Sunday, July 26th from 4 to 6 p.m. Remember, the deadline to run for the local station board is next Sunday, July 26th at 8 p.m. Please visit elections.pacifica.org for more info or contact me.